From the Lynn de Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 23rd day of August, 2024. I'm Extension's Tug Gleason. Today we'll talk with Brian Grady, a pro farmer. He has the national yields and the statewide figures as well for the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. We'll discuss those then with Mike Zuzulo, GlobalCommResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. And as we wrap up our time together in the first half hour, we'll talk with Eric Snodgrass of Nutrien Ag Solutions. If you can stay with us for the second half hour, you'll hear all of Commodity Week with our guests Joe Jansen and Greg Johnson. If not, it's online already at willag.org, and many of these radio stations will carry it over the weekend. September corn for the day settled at 367 and three quarters, down 3 3/4. December 391, 2.5 lower. And the March down 2 cents at 409.5. September beans 952, up 10 3/4. November 973, up 11.5. And January at 990 3/4, up 11 1/4 cents. Bean meal down a dime. The bean oil futures $1.03 higher. Soft red winter wheat down 7.5 at 528. The hard red at 520, down 9 1/4. Both of those in the December contract, cattle were down 20 cents, feeders up 12.5, and lean hogs were up 92.5. Let's begin our program today with the numbers that were released by Pro Farmer, their national yield estimates based off of the Crop Tour. Brian Grady is with us. Thank you, Brian, for taking some time. At 1:30 today, you release the official numbers. What are they?
I'll start off with corn. Our production number is 14.979 billion bushels, an average yield of 181.1 bushels per acre. Now, we put a plus or minus 1% on that, and that would give us a range on the top end of 15.129 billion bushels to a low range of 14.829 billion bushels. Yield there, 182.9 on the top side to 179.3 bushels per acre on the bottom side. The soybeans, 4.74 billion bushels, average yield of 54.9 bushels per acre. With soybeans, we do a plus or minus 2% because it's just more difficult to estimate them in the third week of August. And that would give us production range on the top end of 4.835 billion bushels, on the low end of 4.645 billion bushels. And on the yield, that would be a range of 56 on the top side to 53.8 on the bottom side.
Brian Grady is with Pro Farmer. Just to reiterate, the national corn yield from Pro Farmer at 181.1, USDA currently at 183.1. National soybean yield from Pro Farmer at 54.9, USDA at 53.2. Mike Zuzulo of GlobalCommResearch.com is on the line to talk about the figures. Hi, Mike. Thanks much. What'd you think of the national yields?
I like the corn yield, and I like the bean yield a lot too, Todd. And I say that because one of the things that I picked up on the Central and Eastern crop tour I did was a little bit less than USDA. I'm actually at 181.9 for my national yield. And so that matched up real nicely, because I do think in corn specifically, as Pro Farmer noted, as I noted on my crop tour, there's a lot of variability, a lot of late planted corn out there. And in the sense of beans, you know, pod set this past week was still under 60%, well behind last year. And so we've got a lot of wide open yield right now in beans especially, and even some in corn. So what I said to my clients and subscribers was states like South Dakota, Ohio, Kansas, the outer belt would drag down or pull down further increases in the national yield. And that's why I came in at 181.9 on corn. I'm actually a lot lower than both USDA and Pro Farmer. They're 54.9 today that you reported. I'm actually at 52.4, with the idea that the weather pattern's not going to be conducive to filling out that top third of that bean plant that is going to push us over the edge to those above 53 bushel yield type mindsets nationally.
And you are right that Brian Grady did tell us, or told me, and we've talked about this, that the variability in the outer part of the Corn Belt is where really things will be the not so much the big driver, but it's on the margin that can make the difference. Let's go through some of the state numbers. I'll have you go through the ones you want to, but start here in Illinois. 220 from Pro Farmer, 225 from USDA for corn.
Yeah, and so this suggests that it's going to be hard for corn to see a higher state yield in Illinois with Pro Farmer coming in below, in my opinion. And kind of the same thing with Iowa, with the state of Iowa coming in at 209 for the USDA at a record, Pro Farmer coming in at 212. I think those are pretty much locked in. For me specifically, Todd, it was about the states that Pro Farmer came in lower versus what the USDA came in. So South Dakota is a great example. Pro Farmer came in underneath USDA by about 6 bushels, 5.5 bushels. USDA was seeing a higher yield versus 2023. So that's kind of the, for me, the secret sauce of the Pro Farmer Tour on a day-to-day basis, is to say, do they see less than last year when USDA says more, and vice versa? So we had South Dakota and Minnesota as the two outlier states where the Pro Farmer Tour was lower. USDA was higher in South Dakota, unchanged in Minnesota. So that kind of helps solidify what you and I were just talking about.
Yeah, that Minnesota number at 185 from USDA, and then from Pro Farmer at 170. 194 from USDA and Nebraska, 189 bushels from the Pro Farmer Tour. Is that crop that good?
Yeah, it is. I think that I would edge towards the Pro Farmer numbers, though, because I have heard a lot more about the hotter weather. And this goes for Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska. That hotter weather back during critical times of filling, and that dry land corn that did not make the crop circle on irrigation, I think those will matter. And I just drove from Topeka to Atchison and back just a couple nights ago. And much like central, east central, and west central Missouri along 36 Highway, the hills are pretty burned up at this point. So I think those will be yield drags. And I think we maybe talked about last week, you know, a couple big clients that I work with on those outer perimeters of the Corn Belt said I didn't have any zeros last year. This year I'll have zeros in my field. And I think that will make a difference.
One last corn state to talk about, Indiana, 210 from Pro Farmer, 207 from USDA. When you put all these numbers into context, that national yield, yours or theirs, what are you telling producers going forward as it relates to marketing?
Well, I got half of what I wanted this week with the Federal Reserve confirming a rate cut. The dollar made new multi-month lows, new 2024 lows, but the wheat actually made new multi-year lows as well. That says we're still in a supply weather market, if you ask me. And that means that beans are still in charge as we come back next week, Todd. And these numbers, I think, support that, because you're probably not going to go with the 54.9 yield number if you see Sunday night we're not getting any rains where we were supposed to, and all of a sudden the models dried out, and vice versa. If we see a lot of rains over the weekend, more coming, and a wetter 1st of September bias, then I think the trade will start thinking more about the soybean yield going up. So then beans, I think, would fall back into line with corn and wheat much easier. So that's kind of the dynamic we're trading here in the very short term. And I personally feel like we're still on a 2014 type trajectory where it's easier to go lower than higher, especially with this strike coming back on the Canadian rail, with the union giving them a 72-hour lockout notice. I just don't like that type of supply chain interruption. It usually means lower demand. So I'm getting, you know, back into the hedging mindset, trying to prepare this next 35 days for a lower market instead of a higher market.
Well, I was just about to ask you if you thought the up in the soybean market today might be, and might be the signal for it bottoming, but maybe not just yet.
It's a lot of weather, 80% weather, I would say, the first couple days of the week. And then I think we got to figure out whether the funds are going to treat this potential strike like the pandemic, where they see supply chain problems, yes, creating winners and losers, but overall the supply chain problem resulting in lower demand because of higher prices, shipping costs, and delays in goods. And I could see that scenario play out.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Todd. Take care.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Oh, let's get into the Wayback Machine. I'm feeling a little nostalgic today. All this week, we've been talking about the Pro Farmer Crop Tour, which goes back about 32 years. However, there's another 11 years of Midwest Crop Tour that took place starting in 1983. And in 1989, I went on that tour, which was organized by AgriVisor at the Illinois Farm Bureau.
You're getting into the prostate there.
The roundtable discussion. In the heartland of America, it is often a source of information, a way for farmers to keep up on crop conditions in their neighbor's field. But in a world where agricultural trade encompasses the globe, it falls far short of any real value. These people are in search of a broader perspective. They are floor traders from the Futures Exchange in Chicago, grain merchandisers from the United States, Japan, and Germany, U.S. Department of Ag officials, agricultural meteorologists, and journalists. The one common thread they share is a desire for more information on the American corn crop. But sitting around a table is not how they have come by such valuable information. They are AgriVisor Crop Tour Scouts and have spent the day on the road and in the cornfield gathering vital statistics on the 1989 corn crop.
Our starting spot with that one, we won't count that one, we'll start with this plant. If you'll hold that tape measure, I'll sing out when I got 17.5.
Tour host and AgriVisor market analyst Jim Quinton is making corn yield calculations. To ensure randomness, the calculations are made the same distance into the field each stop, 36 paces in from the edge. He lays off a one-row strip equal to 1/1000th of an acre. In this particular case, the test strip is 17.5 feet long. The number of plants in the strip are counted and multiplied by 1,000 to obtain a total plant count for the entire acre.
18, 19 ears and 1/1000th of an acre, so that's like a 19,000 plant population. For a random selection, we'll take the 7th, the 11th, and the 13th ear. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Peel that down, look at the grain in that cob.
The number of ears on the plants are counted, and then once again to ensure randomness, the same ear numbers from each strip are taken for the final counts in the yield calculations.
8, 9, 10, number 11.
In this case, the ear numbers are the 7th, 11th, and 13th ears in the test strip.
And now number 13. These are three randomly selected ears in the sample. And this one is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 18. So we got 18, 18, and 16. That's an average of 17.3. And the length of the kernels on the cob here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
For the final calculation, the number of kernels around each and the length of each of the three ears are counted and averaged. Then all of the calculations are translated onto the corn yield calculator. It is actually a slide rule.
30 through 1 through 2 through 3 through 4 through 35 through 6 through 7 through 8. Call it 38. And on the calculator, then, if we use number of rows of kernels around the cob, it averaged 17.3. And the length of kernels we'll call 38. So we'll set 38 on about 17.3. Oops, that's down there. There we go. And we had 19,000 plants. That's 139 bushels to the acre. Assuming that the kernel weight will be normal weight. That's what this corn yield calculator cannot do, is tell you whether the kernel size itself is going to be bigger than, smaller than, or about normal.
From here, it's another 20 miles on the road to the next stop. The car talk centers on one thing, crop conditions. Jim Quinton.
Okay, if dry matter accumulates in the corn kernel at the rate of 10% or 1% per day for the first 10 days, 2% per day for the next 40 after pollination, and then 1% per day for the final 10 days, that'd be a 60-day span to have 100% dry matter accumulation from pollination to black layer formation. If this corn is pollinated on August 20th, and you got a killing freeze on September 30th, you would be at the 70 percentile of dry matter accumulation when the day the corn plant died. If that calculated yield for that spot was 192 bushels, that cuts you down to 130 bushels of yield right then and there, overnight. That's all that field would have. And it'd be 130 bushels of some of the most ungodly crap you ever took to an elevator.
20 miles later, it's out of the car and into the field again, where we find just such a situation.
Depending on how these latest stalks pollinate, it could make almost 30 bushels difference in the yield of this particular field. And it's very, very late, and I think we have to question whether even the late stalks will make it before frost.
As you come up on the field from the road in here, this field looks like a good field. If you're just driving by it, I mean, it's probably 12 feet tall. Mm-hmm. Or better, yeah. And green as can be, and there's plenty of moisture out here. Throw you?
Well, that's the old windshield method. And the old windshield method is okay for vegetative matter, but it's not okay for counting grain.
Just over 40 participants rode in 8 cars on this 6-day, 3-day crop tour. What they found was a crop better than suspected, holding its own on the drought-stricken western corn belt and coming out in the rain-soaked east. One other note from the tour. We were reminded of a childhood rule. Look both ways before you cross the road.
Oh, it was fun. Back in 1989, that was my one and only time on a crop tour. It was organized by the Illinois Farm Bureau and the AgriVisor marketing team. Now let's turn our attention to the weather forecast. Eric Snodgrass is here. He's from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agri. Well, hi, Eric. Thank you so much for being with us. By the way, how was your meeting last night in Fairbury, Illinois?
Yeah, they were great. You know, what was funny was just the number of people there that commented on just how beautiful the weather was and how nice and cool it was. But we had a great time in Fairbury just talking about, you know, what's changed over the last 70 years in terms of ag production in Illinois. Very similar to what you and I talked about back in, was that early August or late July?
Yeah.
I can't remember, but we were together over in Peoria. So it was a great talk. Enjoyed.
Oh, fantastic. So since they were asking you about the cool weather, I know what they asked. Is there a chance because of the cool weather now that we will get a frost or an early freeze?
Yeah. And so early this week, I wanted to dig into this. And so there's a great website out there. It's called the Midwest Regional Climate Center. So anybody that's listening, just Google that, Midwest Regional Climate Center. When you get to that page, look at their frost maps. So what you'll find is that in Illinois, our typical, you know, first fall frost where our temperatures hit 32 is some point probably in the middle or the third week of October. That's normal. So there's, of course, a distribution around that. And we have had frost been much, much earlier and also much, much later. I mean, there have been some years we don't get our first frost until almost December. So, you know, it's important to understand there's a distribution. But that's what folks are worried about this year. Not maybe here in Illinois, but possibly in the Northwest Corn Belt where there's been a pretty sizable deficit in the accumulation of GDDs. We've not had sustained heat in the Northwestern Corn Belt. I mean, I'm talking about from Iowa and anywhere west to north of there. And given the fact that it was so wet in spring and they had such a late plant, there's just a lot of conversation about the devastation of an early frost because they're not quite yet close to where they want to be with respect to getting the crop finished. So we're looking at a lot of things, and I'm just going to give you kind of the skinny on this, all right? If you're going to get worried about frost and you want to know what to be on the lookout for, watch Alaska. If we see major, major heat building from the West Coast but clear into Alaska, you're going to displace all that warm air north. What happens is the atmosphere reacts by sending a trough to the Great Lakes. And behind those troughs, we tend to get high pressure. With that high pressure, clear skies, light winds. And you get the same thing we've had these last few days around here where the temperatures have bottomed out in the 50s and in some places in the 40s. And even in like the UP of Michigan, they got down into the 30s. Now, the later on you get in the season, the lower the daylight hours, the shorter the days, of course, and then the better the chances are. So what we have to watch is Alaska. I just want to keep a close eye on them to see if they get a major heat wave coming in. If they do, things shift around for us and we have that risk of frost.
Sure. One more place we had to keep track of. I'll make you keep track of that. Now, we have been very cool, but it's going to get hot. Tell me about the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. So the heat that's been in Texas, and they've been breaking records in Texas with this heat, it's going to open up to the Midwest this weekend and for a while next week. So we're going to go back up the temperatures well into the 80s. The Western Corn Belt's going to go up into the upper 90s, low 100s. And question is, how long is it going to last? And the overall story here is that we've got a system coming across the U.S.-Canada border midweek next week, and then one that follows it the next weekend, meaning there will be fronts in the vicinity of this kind of dome of heat that's coming over us that could push it back and knock the temperatures back. So again, it's not very sustained in terms of bringing in high temperatures. And that's, again, it comes back to that frost discussion. Every time we forecast more longer duration heat, it ends up getting curtailed by, you know, fronts that just sweep through, and the models end up being over-predicting on the side of too warm for much of the upper Midwest and Midwest. So yeah, it's going to get hot this weekend. But after that, I think we're going to start to see better chances of more normal late summer weather.
Let's talk about the harvest months. I think producers would start to maybe root for La Nina for a good, nice, dry harvest. But you tell me, it's not developed yet, or not very well, I don't think.
No, it really hasn't. And even though we have a little bit of a drier forecast going forward, there are just small chances of rain for us in the next week to 10 days. You know, the reality is as we go forward, if La Nina did come in full force, which it's trying, it's just not there yet. But if it did come in, we would be looking at a more mild and drier fall. But you know what's interesting, Todd? We can't really say that August has been overly wet for a lot of folks. And I know you and I over here in Mahomet, we got big rains last week. And of course, we're looking at wet conditions. But around the rest of the state, parts of Iowa, a lot of the Mid-South, the Ohio Valley have been dry. In fact, this morning, I checked the Mississippi River levels at Memphis. They're actually below low stage right now. So the dryness late summer, all that wet weather early in the spring didn't really, you know, do much to keep the river levels high as we now get to the end of this this summer time period. So back to your question, though, La Nina, you know, is it fully going to engage? And if it does, what do we get? I'll just say this. If it does, we have better chances of mild conditions, drier conditions, and a better fall for harvest. If it doesn't, then that frost risk comes back in again. And we got to think about the implications of maybe having some early season cold. So man, there's a lot on the table. And if you're getting any sort of a hint that I don't know what's going to happen, that's exactly what I'm trying to tell you, Todd. There's a lot on the table that could change around in the next couple of weeks.
Well, here east of the Mississippi and to the south, we are rooting then, I guess, for it not to come in. Sorry to say that.
Yeah.
Okay. So last thing, South America.
So this has been a bit of a troubling forecast. South America came off of one of its driest dry seasons on record. So the last 3 months, most locations weren't just dry, but they were completely dry. They were warm, high evaporation rates. But it's the dry season. You can have one big rainfall event in September, October that just negates all of that. So here's the issue. Most of the models have been predicting a dry September and dry front half of October. And I'm just going to call that into major question here because I think they're biased too much to the initialization, meaning the fact that they were started during such a dry time period, they're just carrying that forward. Some new evidence came out this morning, though, that we could have better rains in the second half of September, the start of October. And if that does come in, they are going to plant very, very quickly, which for our market behavior, we would want that to not happen. We want a very slow plant with problems so that our markets have to cover the offset of their crop production calendar. So I'm looking at all of this, and unfortunately, that's a turn in the wrong direction. If they're able to get that moisture in early, they'll plant very, very rapidly on that.
Hey, thanks much.
Yeah, you bet.
Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions in Daggerville and joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.